This is Talking T20. We are running towards the end of another IPL. And today we have amidst us the first left-arm spinner in Test history to take 350-plus Test wickets. So, record breaker of sorts in all formats, Tests and ODIs. And lately, he's become a T20 regular in terms of coaching teams all around the world. He's been with the Royal Challengers Bangalore. Dan Vittori, pleasure to welcome you, Dan.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, as usual, is Gaurav Sundararaman, who's happened to work with Dan in the past in the IPL. Is that right, Gaurav?
Yeah, but not directly. But when he was not available, he was actually playing the World Cup in 2015 for New Zealand. And the franchise, I just replaced some of the guys in the franchise because all of them were busy with the World Cup.
Okay. Lovely. So we have a panel again, and there's lots to run through with Dan, especially considering his experience with teams, coaching and playing over the years. Dan, before we get to the serious stuff, always wanted to ask you, since when have you started wearing prescription spectacles? You're one of the very few to wear while batting and bowling.
Three. So I was very young. So I don't know anything else. I tried to wear contact lenses once, but my astigmatism is too strong, so I couldn't wear contact lenses, and I've never found it a hindrance to wear glasses. So, yeah.
Has it ever been broken during a game by bowling?
You used to play soccer as well, did you?
But I didn't wear them playing soccer, so I just needed them for cricket.
Not once the ball hit the. That's
impressive.
That's amazing.
When you're already ducking the ball before it's fouled, it's easy to get out of the
Has
way.
It fallen on when you're diving in the boundary? Or
no, no.
Wow.
No, nothing.
Mitch Santner is carrying on the tradition of New Zealand left-arm all-rounders, left-arm spin bowling all-rounders wearing spectacles while batting. Yeah. Right. Let's get on to the main stuff then. How have you found working in the IPL over the years, and what's basically the difference between this tournament and the rest? What's something that separates the tournament? Have you considered it to be a notch above the other leagues? Or
I think if you'd asked me 3, 4, 5 years ago, then definitely the IPL, because the culmination of all that talent coming together, an open season, pretty much everyone being available, and the strength of the Indian players, I think that really separated itself from the rest of the tournaments. But I think the other tournaments have learned a lot from the IPL, not only on the field but off the field, in terms of the way they set things up, the structure, the professionalism. And because of that, I think the IPL's jumped another level. And I think the professionalism that's in all IPL teams now is fantastic for the sport, because first and foremost, it's senior international guys, whether it's Indian or overseas players, setting a trend, and then that's followed on by the younger guys. So I think the in particular, what the IPL does well is it exposes young Indian players to international cricket, and therefore when they get to international cricket, they're so far ahead of their contemporaries in other countries. So for the likes of a Chahal to go from where he was just making an IPL team to being pretty comfortable making the Indian team is a step that I think it's difficult for other leagues to make. So if a young Australian player does well in the Big Bash, it's not necessarily a stepping stone for him to perform in international cricket.
You're saying that because the quality of the opposition and...
Probably the quality of the opposition, but I think more the pressurised atmosphere. I think the crowd sizes, the expectations of the franchise are very different. And I think that's balanced up with a private ownership versus still being part of state franchise or state organisation as well as being a national thing. So, look, I think you could list all the little things that happen there and there, but I think they're getting closer and closer. But I think ultimately the other leagues around the world have tried to emulate the IPL.
Rare is the opportunity that we get an established T20 coach on Talking T20. He talks about professionalism and how things have changed. Part of the thing is stuff you do, just data and feeding them into teams. Have you seen a difference in how teams receive data? We've spoken about this in the past, so I'd like to get Dan as well. Have you seen a difference in how teams receive data and stuff from the outside rather than just think tanks and them planning it before in previous editions of the IPL, maybe the start of the IPL in the early 2000s or late 2000s?
So I think it all depends on the kind of personnel you're dealing with. Various franchises deal with it differently. With my experience with Mumbai, it was very different. They went very deep. It was part of their strategy and tactics. So every team meeting will have, the analysts will play a big role. Whereas in a team like Chennai, it was purely only for bowlers and all bowler-related information was only relayed. So I think, again, that boils down to kind of franchise you work for. And again, when it comes to individual players, I think that, again, some people work use data to improve their skills, technical skills. Some people use it for strategies on which bowler whom they can potentially target, what are the areas he's likely to bowl. So it's becoming a very individualistic thing, but I would like to see it driven from the top, like the owners actually drive that and instill that in the captain and coach, because I think it plays a big role, especially in the shortest format, where we've seen a lot of successful case studies.
Dan, you've been around since 2008 in the IPL. You've started with Delhi Daredevils and, of course, through Royal Challengers and then becoming a coach. What side of this debate are you on? Do you see potential for use of data in regular decisions and day-to-day decisions? Are you in the other camp where, you know, you rely more on the captain's and coach's instinct to what you've learned over the years?
I think there's two parts, and Gaurav makes a really good point around the data should be geared around the personnel in terms of the leadership. So I think the two examples he gave are brilliant because they're the two most successful IPL franchises, and one's obviously geared with Chennai around being intuitive, instinctive around match situations, and then Mumbai, I know Shane Bond well, and I know how much he relies on data and how important it is for him, and they go around a more structured, more planned version of it, but they're both sort of getting similar sort of results. So you can see straight away that it both can work. For me, I think there's such a strong correlation to thorough planning and the use of data to performance, and I think it's so important because I think cricket in general is quite immature in terms of its exposure to this, and the sport that I like is baseball, and I think they use it more strongly than anyone.
Sabermetrics and...
Exactly, and I think the thing that they have in their favour is they have huge sample sizes, and the thing that I always battle with was, here's a good plan, and then go back, well, how many times it's worked? Well, it's worked four times. And four times doesn't seem like enough to base things on. I think that's what, when you're presenting to a captain or an owner or the rest of the coaches, you want to be overwhelming with it. And I know that in baseball or a lot of the sites that I follow, they want sort of 500 instances of that to happen before they can sort of guarantee, you know, a prediction that they can rely on. And when you're dealing with sort of Dave Warner facing Chahal, you know, 33 times over the course of his career, and then you make a prediction from that, I think that's the thing they worry about. But that's only going to grow. So while we're in these infant stages, I think it's hard for people to get their heads around. But the people that buy into it first and get their heads around it, I think you can get the jump start on everyone.
If Dan Vettori, the coach, were to tell Dan Vettori, the player, from 2009 or 10, this is what the matchup is, this is how you should bowl, would you think the bowler would listen to the coach back then?
I think you always got to present a case. I think it just can't be as simple as you've got to bowl now because the numbers say that's the right thing to do. I think there's a lot of, as I said before, intuition around it, and I think senior experienced players, whilst they probably don't always admit that they... You know, they go by the numbers. Somewhere in the back of their head, they're working to that. And their previous experiences, which is basically just building a data set, isn't it? So, look, I think if once again, it's building the case, telling the story, and then providing that to the player, coach, captain, owners, that allows that to flourish.
He makes a great point. The fact that bowlers will not admit it and they do have it. I've seen that actually happen literally because there are certain things which are told and they don't agree, but when you actually see it on the field, that actually happens. I've seen it happen, and it might work once, it may not work the other time, but the fact that they've actually bought into it indirectly tells you that, okay, maybe he is open to that, and you just need to communicate it in a way in which he understands. And where I would like to ask Dan a very important question is, when he compared cricket to IPL to baseball, where there's a lot more data, which I totally agree. The other factor, big change, which I keep telling a lot of people, is cricket, the most of decisions are made by the captain. In all the other sports, it's made by the manager and coaches. The coach does not have as much power as the captain. So I believe, from my experience, it is so much more important that the captain buys into all this rather than how much ever the leadership group or the owners buy in. So do you see that changing, or do you see that or is that the way it is?
It is the way it is, but I think, but also with people's exposure to all this, then the selection of a captain may be part of the ability to buy into this. And I know that happens in baseball, the selection of a manager who who basically relays the front office material is a person who's obviously on board with that style of thinking. The thing that cricket makes it tougher for cricket versus other sport is it's not a closed skill. I think that's the right thing, where the variables around the pitch, you know, a batsman has to react to things, all that sort of stuff.
Each game is truly different and unique.
Whereas a baseball, you sort of have similar dimensions to the field, this exact dimensions to thrown off the mound. Those sorts of things, I think, make it easier to provide that direction. Whereas cricket, I think you still want to rely on a bit of intuition and understanding of the game, reading of a situation, because that plays a part. So I think, like anyone, ultimately, you just want to marry the two up and somehow get that perfect combination of the two.
You spoke about Shane Bond at Mumbai Indians and how he's studious and he's dependent on data and he likes doing his research. Just following up on the captain's question, is his job made easier by the fact that, or the perception that Rohit Sharma is somebody who trusts the matchups and the data? Does it just help the coach that a captain buys into it that much more?
I think so, but once again, I think that's probably a relationship for Shane and Rohit that they've built up over a number of years, and because Shane is so diligent in that preparation, then I think that allows that to happen. So, look, I think it's like I said before, a captain's got to be able to think on his feet and understand things, and a bowler's got to be able to think on his feet and see if a plan's not happening, and then back to the data side of things. You want, unless you've got an overwhelming case, it's almost don't present it, and then let the captain and bowler work it out either for themselves or an appreciation of the situation, what's going on in the game.
And just on T20 with the dugout, etc., you're that much more closer to the action. It's unlike any other format. And we see occasionally coaches, we've seen on Ashish Nehra this year with RCB, instruct the captain on whom to bowl or suggest to the captain. Do you see this sort of in-game coaching becoming more prevalent across leagues, or is it just a one-off case that still happens?
No, I think probably it probably happens with every franchise. It's probably just not as demonstrative as we saw in that situation. I think the coach and captain, the assistant coaches, the 12th men are relaying information the whole time. And then obviously the strategic timeouts happen as well. And there's another opportunity there to provide that information to the captain and players. So I think the players want it as well, because there's so much going on in that situation. Just to have a quiet conversation, is this a good option, is this not a good option? Because then it's not all about the captain having to feel like he's by himself making the decision. It's like, okay, we're all in this together. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, then we are all in this together. And I think sometimes a captain gets hung out to dry around decision making when we all know it's a collective effort. We're all in it together, and not just the captain and coaching staff. It's the senior players. It's everyone involved that you understand as a team. We hope this is going to work. We're not positive it's going to work, but we'll try it together.
We've got a reasoning behind why it might just work. Right. You've had your set of highs and lows with RCB. You've made it to the final of a season, 2016, right? The question that we all keep thinking about, we keep talking about, is your experience of working with Virat Kohli, the T20 captain. What kind of captain was he? Which side of this debate does he fall on? Can you take us through a little bit of that?
I mean, Virat's amazing as a leader. I think there's always two sides to leadership, and I think I've said this a number of times in the past, that when you see Virat on the field, you can't. It's contagious, and I think that energy, that enthusiasm, the desperation to win, is something that I know every player at RCB, and I think players who look from the outside go that's amazing, and you couple that with, you know, the best batsman in the world, and with a work ethic that has probably led India into the situation they are now. I mean, everyone wants to follow his gym, everything he does off the field, the way he basically prepares to play the game. So that's a huge part of leadership. That's a huge part of captaincy. And then I think Virat's a guy who's exceptionally open to ideas. And I think so when I used to speak to him, or any of the coaches speak to him, there's always a conversation around what he thinks best, where can this work. It wouldn't always be a numbers-driven conversation. It would be around some intuition and understanding of the game. So I think ultimately when you sold a compelling story to Virat. He was always on board, always open to listen, and that made him such a good captain and such a good leader for RCB. Mm.
How much of influence does a captain play in the auction? If you look at IPL, for example, at RCB, did you have input such that we need this player, or was it more about the skill set and the player was up to you guys to do whoever you want? Because a lot of times I feel that that's where sometimes 50% of the tournament is won, where you pick up a good team who can kind of handle any situation, any pitch. And like if you look at Bangalore as a whole over the last 4-5 years, we know how difficult a ground it is, Chinnaswamy, to bowl in the death, but they haven't like really unearth a major death bowling talent. And whereas you see Mumbai Indians, they've always had people playing for India from that. So would you be able to tell us why is that happening, or why was a great death bowler not bought by RCB, or was it just that it just didn't, the execution failed?
I think the first question is it's a collective. I think the owners are involved, the management, coaching staff and captain and senior players as well. I think we always knew that Virat and AB were going to be with the franchise, so we'd like to collate their thoughts and get an understanding, particularly around AB, around South African players, and Virat. You know, he knew a lot of the players and obviously understood them. So I think the inputs were there, and so we try and take them on board as much as possible. But the auction takes you in a million different places. I've never experienced anything like it till I was
in any other league.
Yeah, I mean, it's unique. It's irrational. It's amazing. You win some.
Did you watch them live as a player when you were bought?
No, I didn't know.
There
no.
was a $500,000 bid for you at one point from RCB.
I'm very grateful for that. I appreciate Delhi and RCB for bidding on me. But I think that as a player, you had a, you know, that was excitement. You hope it worked out well. But you also, I think the guys who went into it with the right mindset of, I hope I get what I'm worth, not I hope I get more than someone else, because of that irrationality of the auction. I think once you're in it, there are players you get that you at no stage thought you were going to get. You thought there were no chance, and you had no desire to bid on them because you thought they were going to go too far, and then you get them, and then all of a sudden you look at all your list of things that you had in front of you, and okay, we've got to jump in a different direction. I think that's the excitement of the auction, and it's probably the thing that people don't understand unless you're in it. So I think, look, I look at the last auction I was involved in, the team that we walked away with was exactly what we wanted. We thought it was a fantastic team. Mm. And I think, you know, the pundits, everyone said it was a great side. Ultimately, you've still got to perform, and that's where it comes down to. Everyone said Chennai was a team that would struggle last year, and they had performances. And so whenever a team's critiqued, or you know, bad auction or bad selection, ultimately for myself as a player, I just didn't perform. That was as simple as that, because you know every player that's in that team can perform, can do well, because they've proven it time and time again. Mm. And for whatever reason on that day they didn't, and that leads to a performance that leads to a loss, which leads to everyone saying bad auction or bad team assembly. I think There's too many layers from performance that doesn't work to everything else, and I think as a coaching staff you've got to bring it back to, okay, on this day this individual didn't work. Mm. How can we help them for the next game, rather than going to the extreme? Mm.
This has basically been billed as the age of wrist spin, and so many more wrist spinners coming into the fray. So many of them get big bids at the auction. You'd have seen that yourself. I'm just going to talk to you about your breed, which is the finger spinner. Talking two specific examples, Mohammad Nabi and Ravi Ashwin. Mohammad Nabi, of course, a very classical off spinner, right-hand version of you, probably. Correct me if I'm wrong. Why do you think only a few of these guys stand out more and more in a field that's becoming full of wrist spin?
Are you saying right arm off spin or left arm?
Left arm or right arm. Shakib would be a left arm example.
I think, I mean, you look at every team. I mean, look at the game last night with Chennai and Delhi. They played six spinners amongst them, and I think how many, Habajan, Jadeja, Akshar Patel, and I'm missing one other, I think another.
Jagdish Sachin.
So there's four finger spinners there. Yeah. So I think if you actually scroll through the numbers, There are the finger spinners still succeeding, but I think...
Doing the defensive job.
I think it's probably the wrist spinners are getting the figures that stand out. And the Tahir has been fantastic. You look at Mishra throughout the history of the IPL, he's always had big wicket games. And I think, so probably maybe those big wicket games are coming to the finger spinners. But I think ultimately, finger spinners are getting selected for every game because they are performing a role. It's probably just not the... quite that marquee role that we see from the wrist spinners.
It's probably also because Gaurav, they tend to spin it both ways. It makes them that much more attractive as a proposition. When you recommended names for auction picks, right? Where did finger spinners stand in the scheme of things? Because your experience is a little more recent in terms of 2013 to 16 or so, approx.
So ultimately, a lot of factors in the IPL dictate the kind of spinners you want. Like if you have, sometimes people used to say that a lot of overseas recruits, most teams had overseas top openers or top three had at least one overseas batsman for sure, most teams. So you know that they are generally weak against spin. We've seen a lot of people from the Big Bash come here or any other leagues for that matter come, but they don't actually do well in the IPL. So one thing is they're not able to read googlies, for example. If you see Shreyas Gopal this year, he's bowled more googlies than his actual stock delivery. So I think the variation was key. So those are small things like finger spinners. I think Ashwin's one person who's constantly been innovating and he's figured out that then to survive he needs different skills. So maybe that's why the spinners are getting more preferred, because they have that variation and they're okay to go for runs, but they're sure to get wickets. So the fact that the googly was some skill which we used to see a lot, and not many bowlers had that, and the bowlers who bowled well, we were sure that they are likely to affect an overseas batsman. And then we figured out a lot of Indian players couldn't pick up the googly and they started playing badly. So I think that is the skill we see more than whether he's a wrist spinner or a finger spinner. If a finger spinner has a delivery, which a slider, for example, which not many players can pick, and we've seen that in various leagues. And when you see in other leagues where data sometimes gets misleading, is that you just see somebody's economy rate of 5.8 and a good average, and you just pick, but you actually need to watch to see what kind of batsman he picked, whether he picked up tailenders, whether he picked up top order batsman, was it international. I remember somebody telling me before picking up Rashid Khan in 2017 that in the BPL, Mahil and Sangha had no idea how to pick him. Almost an entire over, a couple of overs, struggled to pick him. And Mahila badly wanted him for Mumbai Indians. In fact, Mumbai did bid for him, but Hyderabad outbid them. So those are small things. You want to see who are the batsmen, what kind of variation they do. And we're seeing the results now with Rashid Khan. So it's not just that straightforward, according to me.
Dan, do you remember which batsman you got out most times in T20s?
Not T20s. I can tell you Test.
Gaurav's just mentioned his name.
Mahela.
Sangakkara.
Sangakkara.
Four times.
I did not like bowling to Sangakkara. I didn't mind bowling to Mahela, but not Sangakkara.
But do you remember in tests?
Yeah, Warney. Oh.
Yeah, 99 nice. As well.
Yeah, I think Warney got me out the most as well. Just two spinners trying to slog each other.
If you had to change something in T20 cricket in terms of the way teams are approaching it, is there anything in mind which you had a theory and a lot of teams didn't seem to buy in, or you still feel that this has to be done? For example, is wickets very important in T20 in the sense for the batting team? Do you want your best batsman to get most balls, for example? These things are, there are a lot of theories floating around. Did you have anything which people are not following?
I think the thing, it's interesting that I think a lot of those things are feel things, and on the day they can change. The thing that I reckon, I've talked to other people about, is those tangible things that you can make a difference with. So if you don't bowl any extras throughout a tournament, does that give you a significant chance of winning? If you don't drop any catches throughout a tournament. And those two things you can go to a team and say, this is what we're going to be the best at. Because when you're trying to sell, let's go and score these runs off this many balls, batsmen rightly so say, well, this wicket doesn't dictate this. This doesn't dictate this. So we've got to get a feel on the day, and et cetera. And I think early on the coaching, you try and set up a game plan around batting and bowling. And a lot of that can be intuitive at times. But I like the tangible things that this can make a direct difference for us winning. And it might not be in that game, but over the course of the season, does it give us half a win, a win, or something like that? And so whether I think teams sometimes dismiss that or that, that'll work itself out in the end. Yeah. But if you can have that as a starting point, then maybe there's something in that.
Maybe something we need to check how the previous IPL teams have done. Lease textures, yeah. Win titles. We saw that with tosses recently. Most tosses won correlates to a championship.
Catches must have a huge bearing on it. I mean, RCB season this year would be completely different.
Absolutely.
From a catching perspective.
Dan, interesting you talk about the fielding and the catching side of things. As a coach, has it frustrated you that cricket still doesn't have proper metrics, even basic metrics for fielding? It's such an important thing that teams and coaches do look into, isn't it?
Yeah, because I don't think you can properly, I suppose, adjust for how good a fielder is or how bad a fielder is, and then that adds value to the selection table. When you're in those spots where you're not sure who does offer more value from those perspectives. So I think that could be the quickest improvement from the analysis is how we get a unified or standardized fielding metric system. Because I know, once again, back to the baseball, I know how they sort of graph a field and chop it up and they work out this player can get to this point and this player can't, and I think that would hold a lot of weight and a lot of value for franchises in particular.
Gaurav, you started writing about basic metrics. This is 2019, we're still writing about dropped catches, and we've just gotten to that point. From an analytics point of view, where are we, do you think teams measure more and more these days, or is there a long way to go in terms of cricket getting to that point?
No, there are some challenges. You know, most of the data is collected off TV, and obviously they don't show off the ball positions too much. So unless you have...
We don't even get a graphic saying who's fielding where. It's
very,
such a hard
very
thing
difficult.
To do.
They just show it once or twice.
It's the constant, isn't it? Where baseball is a constant, that person's always at third base, so you know where he can move. Whereas one day a fielder's at point, then he's at long arm, then he's at mid-wicket, and it's just... Yeah, it's tricky.
It's similar to soccer where you don't... you see where people who are not with the ball are actually positioned, right? You need something like that, and... like Dan said, it'd be really amazing to see how fast player A runs from one position to another to take a catch, whereas how fast player B does. Desmond Haynes...
That could go into the auction.
Yeah, probably. That could. When I was working with Desmond Haynes, he made a very good point about a fielder. He said, look, that guy had to... He took three steps. After catching the ball, he took three steps to actually throw the ball. So that was a good insight to me. There might be a player who actually throws it with immediately after picking it, one step. So he felt that one extra little, that little second is extra for them to make another run. So those are things which we love to measure. Right now it's not there, and unless technology comes where you're able to see map this data and constantly maybe in some form coordinate or some form send it back, and then I think Hawkeye should be able to do it. I'm very surprised it's still not happening now.
Probably has to do with the amount of money that goes into the broadcast budget as well. Dan, getting back to coaching and the various teams you've been with, the other big team that you've managed is Brisbane Heat. Gaurav was telling us a while ago about how the two grounds are similar in some sense. The Chinnaswamy in Bangalore.
Terrifying.
No, in terms of how batting friendly the two grounds are, the Chinnaswamy Stadium and the Gabba in Brisbane. Going to a slightly zoomed out perspective, what's been the difference between the BBL and the IPL? Does the BBL have more innovative things happening there in terms of coaching? Do you have... No. More cutting edge stuff coming in terms of, I'm talking of stuff like more innovative ways to practice range hitting or batting cages and stuff like that.
No, I still think the IPL probably is setting the tone for everything in terms of franchise cricket. So I think whilst maybe practice facilities and things like that, you have a constant and probably less pressure on in terms of BBL where it's always set up for you. I think the IPL in a lot of ways is the benchmark for franchise cricket and what they're trying to do on the field, off the field, marketing and everything. And I think even if other franchises around the world, I think if they're honest, they always look to the IPL to see what's happening and see them as the front runners of franchise cricket. So I think, once again, I think there's a lot of emphasis put on the product on the field. And now, like we're talking about the resource that's put in to analytics, I think what the next step for all franchise cricket is to sort of match up that resource that's on the field to off the field, because then that value can be added off the field onto it. Because at the moment, I think like you guys are talking about, you've got relatively small resources dedicated to some really important stuff, and to actually make the most of it, then a lot of time and effort and money will have to be put into it to actually make it worthwhile. Because I think a lot of franchises around the world don't pay it cursory, but it's not as in-depth as it is, and I think that finds its way to the players, and they say, well, that's okay, but it's not enough to sort of change my mind on things. Not that players are anti it or anything like that, but I think ultimately you want to sell that story that this is a way forward, this is how we can get the best out of not only an individual but the team, so that's always a positive. I think there's always a little bit of people are guarded against it for whatever reason, so you just want to make it a positive experience for everyone involved.
Just because there's newer things coming to the game, which
newer things are probably they haven't experienced it. There's just even though it's been around a little while, I think ultimately a player experiences it when he goes to the bowlers meeting. That's the only time, and it may be really simplistic, and it may be video orientated. Captains, coaches, they obviously spend a lot more time with it, and there's a lot more layers to it. But from a player perspective, they don't see anything when they're coming up through age groups. They don't see anything really at a domestic team. And all of a sudden, they're confronted with it at possibly an international level or possibly a franchise level.
And Donovan's so, still so small.
Sure, and players' time is really valuable, particularly in the IPL. The travel schedule is exhausting. To grab a player and go through a in-depth analysis on his game or on the team he's coming up against is tricky, and I think we don't appreciate how hard it is on players, practice, sponsors' commitments.
It's what we don't see, isn't it?
Yeah, and the travel, it's exhausting. And then you go to a player and you've got all this in-depth analysis and you can just see their face glaze over and you go, okay, and maybe this is not the right time. I'll get you again another time.
Moving on to some lighter stuff, not lighter stuff particularly, but less data-centric stuff. So many of you Kiwis in the IPL, we've seen Stephen Fleming, Mike Hessen, now Shane Bourne we've spoken about. Talk us through a little bit about your former captain and current CSK coach, Stephen Fleming, and his coaching philosophy, because he's also at the BBL where you both work for different teams. Talk us through his coaching philosophy and what seems to be working for him at the Super Kings.
Well, I think in a lot of ways I don't know his coaching philosophy because I think you have to be intimate with a team to understand that. I suppose I can relate it to his captaincy and what he was like as a captain. And I think talking to him and hearing other people talk, it's reasonably similar. And I think Stephen was always about building a strong team and a strong team culture.
Heavy on man management?
And empowering people to make decisions, empowering people to learn as they went along, and that culminated in performances. And I think what CSK have done better than every other team is have Dhoni, which is a a great starting point. But I think that they've empowered a lot of players who have come through that system to be at their best. And I think that's the ultimate compliment to Stephen and MS and everyone else in there, is that players go there and perform. And that's... I think a product of the culture, it's a product of probably lots of little things in there, but that is a testament to the leaders within the organisation. A
couple of last questions, one of which is, of course, I was speaking to Brad Hodge as well on this podcast a while ago. He's been the coach in the IPL. How much does the tournament allow you to build young talent to bring it to the forefront? Because your end objective remains the same. Within 14 games, you need to qualify for the playoffs. How much does it allow for an objective like bringing up newer talent to the forefront? Or is that a utopian?
Everything allows you to try and win. So I'll try and work through that. The tournament allows you to build young players up if you're winning. The tournament allows you to play senior players if you're winning. So I think it's all about that. And I think, people conflate a lot of different things around, oh, this team's bringing young players through, that's why they're doing well.
We're seeing from the outside.
Yeah, ultimately, you sit in a selection meeting and try and pick the best team to win the game. And if they win, it justifies everything you've done. And in some ways,
your scouting networks
embellishes your thoughts about things, rightly or wrongly. And then you take to the next game and then can either be torn apart or you go again with it. So I think the winning is the thing that allows you to not necessarily try things, but be emboldened by that selection. And then that might be back in a Safra Scar, even though we didn't do well in the first game, but we won the game. And I think Chennai is another great example of continuing to pick Shane Watson because they're winning, and then he's going to pay off for them in the end. So
look, probably easier to do with a proven star like Watson.
Sure, but there's so many balls in the air.
Yeah.
But winning is the only thing that sort of satisfies the decision makers within the organisation.
That's all about the time we have for in this episode of T20, Talking T20, which we've enjoyed a lot with Daniel Vettori. Thanks very much, Dan. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gaurav.
Thank you.
And thanks always to you, listener, for listening to Talking T20. As you remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, or anywhere else you get your podcast from. Remember to leave us a rating on iTunes. It helps more people find our podcast. And as the IPL goes along and we drift into the World Cup, we'll have more Talking T20, probably talking World Cup from the World Cup and our correspondents out there. Thanks once again for listening, and look forward to your company next time.